You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In yesterday's New York Times Magazine, contributing writer Robin Marantz-Hennig looked at the field of humanoid robots, machines that exhibit certain cognitive and social abilities. The article called The Real Transformers brings Robert Hennig to my show today, along with prominent humanoid robotics researcher Rodney Brooks, professor of robotics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And I'm very pleased to welcome them both to the show. Hello.
Hello, Leonard.
Yeah, hi.
Robin, we've been hearing about the possibility of human-like robots for a long time, even before HAL. Do these new robots make what science fiction writers have been imagining for years a reality?
Well, they bring us a little closer to reality, but there's still a long way to go. To actually create a humanoid machine that can think and learn and do all the things that the science fiction versions do takes much more skill and computer abilities than we're able to do yet.
So in some ways, this is closer to your last article for the New York Times about evolutionary theories. This is about an evolution of a different sort.
That's true. And what also is similar about it, in my earlier article where I talked about evolutionary theories of religion, I indicated that there seems to be some sort of a mechanism in our brains that sees creatureness in anything that moves. And that seems to be what's at play in the way we interact with robots as well.
Well, we see faces everywhere, you know, wrinkled sheets, clouds.
That's right. And it doesn't
stains on walls.
It doesn't take very much to make these robots look sort of like humans. You know, there are some terrific photographs that go along with the magazine article, and they're very mechanical looking creatures, but they have eyes and a head and arms, and so we kind of fill in the gaps and make them seem like creatures to us.
Actually, they look to some degree like some art, some sculptures that I've seen over the years, probably inspired by the early collaborations between Picasso and Gonzalez.
Yes,
we put a slideshow of some images of the new robots on our show page at WNYC.org. Before we get to Rodney, can you describe your first encounters with the sociable robots?
It was a little frustrating. I had sort of been geared up to think that they could do a lot of things because of what I'd been reading about, and also, I must admit, because of some of the science fiction imagery that I'd been studying. You know, as part of writing this article, I watched a lot of the old movies, things that I don't usually watch. And so when I first came to MIT to see some of these robots, it became clear that they don't work seamlessly. They're not thinking autonomous creatures yet, and sometimes things stop working. There was one creature in particular that I was exposed to when I first got to MIT that was supposed to look at you directly at your face and kind of recognize faces. And it had a set of phrases that it was saying, but they weren't necessarily meaningful phrases. And it kind of didn't, its camera wasn't quite working, so it couldn't quite see my face, and it couldn't quite recognize me, and it was looking up at the ceiling instead of looking at me. And things go wrong because they are machines, and they're sort of a work in progress.
But you're calling them creatures.
I just noticed that in myself.
Now, Roddy, do you think of them as creatures?
Well, it's certainly a goal. We're trying to build creatures, but I want to reiterate what Robin says. You know, what we're doing here in a lab is just barely getting things to work, and that's what lab work is about. It's not like these robots are ready for prime time, ready to be delivered to people to work on an everyday basis. And that's part of what she saw. In fact, the first robot she saw when she got here, the graduate student who'd been working on it had been out of the country for 3 months at a postdoc, and so things just lab equipment just doesn't work every day.
But there are very advanced robots, aren't there? Of another sort, not necessarily the sociable ones.
Oh, sure, there are robots that are out in everyday use of all sorts. Robin didn't mention it in her article, but I'm also chief technology officer of iRobot Corporation, and we not only have millions of robots in people's homes for cleaning floors, but we have we've delivered over 1,000 robots to the U.S. military that are used in Iraq and Afghanistan every day to go after IEDs, improvised explosive devices. So those robots are out there and operational and work. But that's a much simpler task than to be social and to interact with people.
What got you into this field in the first place?
Into robotics?
Yes.
Oh, well, I'm Australian. I was a kid about 8 years old in Australia, and for some reason I just got fascinated by making computers and machines. This is in the early 60s, computers and machines where the lights flashed and things happened, and since then I've been hooked trying to build better and better machines.
You were featured in Errol Morris's documentary Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, but I don't remember which one of those adjectives were meant to apply to you.
Probably was, all of them, right, Rodney?
that was actually the title of one of my scientific papers that he used as the title of the movie. That's another story.
Now, so when we're talking about sociable robots, we have to be very specific and actually rather limited. What words and phrases should we be wary of using when describing them?
Well, I think we should be wary of using he and she to begin with. Because, you know, as I call them creatures, there is a tendency to think of them as actual beings. And I worked very hard in my article to make sure that I only referred to these robots as it.
And certainly, in my lab, we only refer to them as it. There's no aspect of gender at all in these robots.
When we talk about programming computers, we say, well, we only can give them what we already know. How does that work here? How has our idea of human intelligence affected robotic research?
They play off each other. We as robotic researchers try to understand what's going on in psychology and neuroscience and understand the latest theories. And sometimes we can do experiments which suggest things to psychologists and neuroscientists to think about, well, what happens in the human system or the rat system based on what they've seen in the robotic system. There's not a direct transfer back and forth between them, but there's certainly an indirect sort of intellectual milieu of what are the questions to think about.
Well, can you tell us about Cog? You're a famous robot from the 1990s.
Yeah, Cog was the first humanoid that we built here at MIT. And, you know, there is no single Cog because every PhD student who did their thesis on Cog would have a different set of programs on a basic set of programs that they all used, and they would explore different sorts of capabilities of the robot. So one of the examples that Robin gave in her article was some work by Matthew Williamson with having the robot play with toys like slinkies and pendulums and feel how the thing that it was given, maybe it was given a crank on some days. In fact, we did give it a crank to turn. We gave it a drum set to play with drums and hear the noise as it beat the drums. And try and couple into those external devices and feel how those devices operate and then learn to use them. So learn to get a slinky to go back and forth from left hand to right hand in time with the basic mechanics of the slinky. So given a different mechanical device, the robot would adapt and do different things.
What made people respond to the robot as if it was a social being?
Well, that was really in its eyes, which are cameras. But it's got two eyes, just as we do, because with two eyes you can get stereo, you can get depth information by triangulating, and that's what we all do with our human eyes all the time. And the eyes swing around in saccade. You and I move our eyes rapidly from spot to move our fovea, which is our central focus area in our eyes, from place to place. And we might do that two or three times a second. So the robot would do that to look at things of varying interest, and that was okay, but then we added the capability that humans have that really made it feel much more alive, and that is, if you suppose you're sitting there and you see something off in the right-hand, you know, field of view of your eyes, your eyes will saccade very rapidly, ballistically swing to that motion over on the right, and then you will turn your head so your head faces the thing that you just saw, and your eyes will remain locked on that thing, effectively turning left in your head as your head moves right, while the eyes stay in space at a constant direction. When we added that capability to the robot, then suddenly people felt that it was animate in some sense. It was a real, quite a different feel about the robot, just from that simple addition to it.
And that's only possible because of developments in videos and sensors?
Yeah, because we can do real-time vision now. We can certain sorts of vision. We can understand motion. We can understand saturated colors. We can pick out things of interest in the low-level way, very similar to the way the human visual system has things of sort of interest, focus of attention, which draw your eyes to something, and then you more cognitively analyze them at a slower time scale.
But Rod, wasn't it also possible because it was something that you were hoping to create, because you cared about making the robot seem more human-like by the way that it did its gaze direction?
Well, actually, that wasn't the real driver. The real driver was what it should pay attention to, and then moving its head, if its eyes had swung way over to the right, then it didn't have much more room to move further to the right if it needed to, so it made sense to have it move its head to be centrally located that way. The same reason, I suspect, that we evolutionarily have developed that capability. But that was what was the real driver. And then out of that, we observed this reaction in people. It wasn't actually something we predicted.
Robin, can you tell us about MIT Professor Cynthia Brazile's robot, Kismet? How was she different? Or I said she. Isn't that weird? How was that creature different from Cog?
Well, Kismet, Cynthia Brazile, was a graduate student with Rod and worked on Cog. And then she wanted to do her own project. And she developed a robot that was specifically expressive and sociable. And, that was what her goal with Kismet was. And so Kismet had more facial expressions than Cog did. It had the eyes that were also able to track you and follow you, but it also had eyebrows and ears and a mouth that had very recognizable expressions of happiness and sadness, and it had a voice that babbled the way a six-month-old baby babbled. So Cynthia worked into Kismet a human interaction kind of program. It was able to make some babbling speech and wait for you to speak back to it and respond to the tone of your voice with different facial expressions and different ways of holding its head. I never got to interact with Kismet in real life because it's been retired and it's on display now at the MIT Museum. But when I saw videos of it, it was quite uncanny, and people were, when they interacted with it, kind of started to laugh and just had a good time with it because it was like dealing with a little baby, but it was very clearly something that was made of steel.
But what's gained by this other than an entertainment factor?
Well, Cynthia was able to program it in a way that it actually learned some new things by the interaction. It actually was able to learn some new words and to, I think Rod can help me with this a little bit. I think that it was able to figure out what kind of delay was necessary and what other kind of sort of learning experiences were necessary that learned
maybe,
in the way
maybe
that
I could jump in here if you don't mind. You asked, what is it beyond entertainment? Certainly entertainment is one application, but also by putting things which we intuitively understand and recognize, we can smooth the interaction with a machine. So we are very good at recognizing gaze direction in other people and in other animals, and other animals are actually very good at recognizing gaze direction in humans. By putting fake eyeballs over the cameras in these robots, it becomes instantly clear to a human observer what the robot is looking at, what it's paying attention to. And thereby, if you're trying to interact with a robot, you understand whether you're getting its attention to what you want it to. If Robin and I were interacting and I was trying to show her a task, I would be demonstrate with my hands, I would be glancing up at her eyes all the time to see where her gaze direction was, to see if she was looking at the thing that I was trying to have her attention at the time. So there's an example of what we expect it to make it easier to interact with robots in the future by having these fairly simple cues, it's something that we as humans are easily able to understand and therefore interact with.
Cynthia, Brazil's robots seem to advance emotions more than yours.
Well, Cynthia started that work here in my lab for her PhD, and she was definitely pushing on emotions, and my own work has moved away from emotions a little bit, and I'm much more interested right now in manipulation, how we can get the robots to deal with unknown objects and grasp them and pick them up and manipulate them.
Leonard, the other idea behind a lot of this is that the thinking is that at some point in the future, maybe in the not-too-distant future, there will actually be robots in our lives, domestic robots that come into our homes and do a lot of things that we want them to do. And Cynthia's thinking, and the thinking of a lot of other roboticists who are interested in this, is that if the robots are coming, they should be created in a way that we can program them to do our bidding easily. And if they interact and learn new tasks in a natural social way, the way that we are accustomed to teaching each other things, then we'll be able to accept them into our lives more easily.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll pursue this further and look into the whole concept of human consciousness and how that relates to machines. My guests are Robin Moranz-Hennig, who's a contributing writer at the New York Times, and her piece, The Real Transformers, was the lead story in yesterday's New York Times magazine. One of the people she wrote about is humanoid robotics researcher Rodney Brooks, a professor of robotics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Stay with us. We're back with Professor Rodney Brooks of MIT and with Robin Moranz-Hennig of the New York Times. Her article, The Real Transformers, was the lead story in yesterday's New York Times magazine. Robin, did any of the people you spoke to suggest that robots could eventually demonstrate even a rudimentary form of human consciousness?
Well, there was one experiment that I thought was pretty interesting that was conducted at Yale University, in which a robot was taught to look in a mirror and guess whether the moving arm belonged to the robot, or to a person. And so in a way, that starts to look a little bit like self-awareness and consciousness, although not yet. I mean, even the individuals who were involved in that research don't think that the robot really knew it was a robot. But there is some thinking that if that kind of ability gets amplified and enlarged upon, that maybe there could be some sort of a self-reflection, some awareness on the robot's part of what its interior environment is like, which is kind of the robot equivalent of the way that we're conscious too.
Rodney, how do you create a robot that exhibits self-awareness?
Well, you know, in with regard to consciousness, we refer to that as the C word in my lab. We don't actually talk about it because we think that there's so much, you know, that's unknown about consciousness, that there's so much wild speculation that we're not going to contribute to that just yet.
And right now, in fact, even in human psychology, there's been a shift from cognitive to social neuroscience. And I don't know whether that's being applied to the possibilities of robotics as well.
Yeah, well, certainly we're paying attention to all that work and trying to put it into our robots where it makes sense, but we just don't think that any of the theories of consciousness are far enough advanced for us to use them in trying to build robotic models of them at this point.
What has the philosopher Daniel Dennett contributed to our understanding of robotic consciousness,
well,
or robotic C-word?
Dan has been an advisor to the COG project and comes over to the lab often, and we have great discussions with Dan. But I think Dan also is not going to say that we're anywhere near putting consciousness in a robot just yet.
Well, he's also written a book about atheism. I suspect that if these robots ever gain any consciousness, they're going to see you as God. People like you, Rodney.
I doubt that.
or at least as father.
Could a robot have an understanding of its own internal states beyond its creators?
Oh, I think so, certainly in principle. You know, and Robin referred to my in-principle argument towards the end of her article. in my view, and I think the implicit view of all modern science is that we humans are machines. We're built out of biomolecules that interact in lawful ways. When you go to a biochemistry class, the professor doesn't say, and then molecule A comes up to close to molecule B, aligns itself, and then the soul intervenes. It's all about mechanics, and that is the view of modern science, that we are mechanical systems built out of molecules. And in my view, then, therefore, in principle at least, one can imagine that anything that can be built out of biomolecules could be built out of other molecules, perhaps silicon and aluminum.
Do you think that this will have a reverse effect, that these robots ultimately will inform our understanding of what it is to be human?
I think they do, because they force us to recognize that we are machines as well. And they force us to sort of ask ourselves, okay, if we're machines and if we're a collection of as Rod says, biomolecules of hormones and neurotransmitters, and they too are sort of machines that have an organizing principle, then what's different about us? They do make us ask that question. Why is it that I shouldn't be calling Domo a he, and should make sure that it's an it and I'm an actual human being? That's what I like about them so much, because it sort of makes you do a double take and ask yourself, why am I different from this robot that I'm looking at?
So can you talk about interacting with Cynthia Brazile's robot, Leo? She gave it a male name, by the way.
Yes, she did, actually. Leo's a little bit different, because unlike many of these other robots at the MIT lab, it's kind of soft and furry and really does look like a creature. It was created by an animatronic studio in Hollywood, in collaboration with Cynthia's lab, and it kind of looks like this strange, it looks like a stuffed animal, but it interacts in a way that's very realistic looking. It sort of blinks its eyes as it's starting to understand something, and it shakes its head and it nods its head, but maybe because it didn't really look humanoid, it looked like a creature, I didn't find myself asking those questions of how am I different from Leo? Because Leo looked like a toy to me.
What about the false belief test that you saw the robot perform?
Yeah, the false belief test was a surprise to me. What the false belief test is something that's used in standard psychology experiments. The thinking is that children, when they're very young, think that everybody knows the same thing they know. And part of developmental psychology, part of growing up, is realizing that you can have one idea and somebody else can have another idea, can have a false belief. So they set up this experiment in which Leo was supposed to act like the child in a false belief test. And lo and behold, it was acting like an older child, a child of 4 or 5, who had learned that other people can be mistaken in what they believe to be true.
So Leo already had developed a theory of mind?
Well, that's what it seemed like to me when I first looked at it on a video. And then when I got to the lab, I realized something that I should have realized from the beginning, that all of that had been programmed into it, that
yeah,
it was given a theory of mind, and it was sort of acting out certain processes that demonstrated it rather than that actually learned it anew.
My guests are Robin Marantz Hennig, who wrote an article for yesterday's New York Times called The Real Transformers. Also with us is Rodney Brooks, professor of robotics at MIT. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So, Rodney, how can you write a computer code that allows robots to model human sociability and give them a theory of mind? It seems like a really complicated code.
It is complicated, and we're not there yet in the full generality that Hollywood would like us to believe is just around the corner. Another example that we've worked on in my group was some work by Tomasello about how words are learned, and there've been theories at various times that kids only learn words and nouns in the presence of the objects that those nouns refer to. And Tomasello was a psychologist who showed how you could teach the kid a kid, a young child, about the names of objects, and he used the word toma from his name for a unique object, where he only said the word toma not in the presence of the object, but by expressing surprise and joy at finding that object later, the kid would then associate the name toma with it. And we did manage to do that with our robot Cog. Paul Fitzpatrick was the student who did that, where everything was learned from scratch, and it was able to learn very different sorts of things. But it's difficult. I like to think of us more like it's 1783 in Paris, and we've just got the hot air balloons flying overhead. We don't quite have the jet airplanes yet.
And as I said earlier, the understanding of how humans work continues to change. The most recent theories involve mirror neurons and how we learn sociability because of them. I suspect that somebody's already trying to apply that to robotics.
Well, what's very interesting also about the idea of human-robot interaction, which is a field of study that Cynthia Brazil is pioneering, is what happens in humans when we interact with robots, not just what robots are learning when they interact with us. And there has been one study, it's very preliminary, that indicates that the mirror neurons that usually fire when you watch another human doing an activity will also fire when you watch a robot doing that activity. So there is something, some commonality that we're searching for that our brains sort of pick out when we're interacting with a machine that looks humanoid.
Of course, that's also because the designers have given these machines eyeballs and ears and eyebrows and mouths, so that we're responding to them on some level as if they are human, with I think probably low expectations.
But you know, there's also there's a group at the MIT lab that's also using robotics in computer monitors and desk lamps that will also move sort of according to the user's body position. And even with those objects, people think of them as, you know, as one graduate student said to me, the lamp will start to move and people will say, what does it want from me?
Well, Rodney, what is the place of robots in popular culture meant for your research?
It's meant very high expectations.
People see robots do all sorts of wild things in movies and in television, and they can't figure out why. What we have so far is so limited.
Why us dumb scientists can't make the robots just as good as in the movies. Yeah, exactly. And I point out that movies also have lots of aliens, and you know, no one's too worried that we don't see aliens on the street.
So the expectations are high, but I suspect they also push scientists into certain directions in attempts to satisfy that, because we can't escape from our own histories, and our own histories involve the popular culture.
Oh, certainly. I think you'll find a lot of researchers have been inspired by science fiction. I was inspired by the robot, if you like, HAL in 2001, when I was a kid growing up in Australia. You know, it did turn out to be a murdering psychopath, but apart from that, it was a pretty great robot.
It was also a lot bigger than a HAL would actually be in 2001.
It was a great movie, though, in terms of how accurate it was compared to so many others.
Well, right. And since Cynthia talks about R2-D2 and C-3PO being her inspiration, I think that is the case, that a lot of Hollywood, if nothing else, it creates a lot of great scientists.
In Japan, robots are sometimes used as substitutes for humans, like the robot therapist Paro the Seal. Is that part of the use of these kinds of sociable robots in the future?
Yeah, Paro, actually, the first prototype was built by Shibata, the person who did that here in my lab in the late 90s. I think Japan sort of has a more accepting view of robots as potentially social equivalents than I think we would have in North America. I will say that there hasn't been a great uptake of those sorts of robots in Japan, and I wouldn't expect there to be great uptake in North America. I think we want our robots to be more functional.
And we also don't want them to replace human interaction. You know, maybe they would amplify it or support it, but there are some people who are very worried that what we're going to do is find robots that will take care of the elderly and that means we don't have to go visit them.
Mm. Yeah, and I prefer to think of prefer to work towards the robots taking care of the dull and mundane tasks, such as, you know, getting the dirty sheets down to the laundry in the hospital and freeing up the nurses to spend more human time with people.
Do you think that to get to the next level, we're going to need something more multidisciplinary? Robotics researchers, psychologists, neuroscientists, and other academics all working together?
Oh, I think definitely, and I think that's what the field of human-robot interaction is sort of aiming at, is in particular getting psychologists in on this.
So yeah, where, Rodney, where do you think things are going to be in 30 years? Oh, you finish what you were going to say.
I was just saying that we already see collaborations between neuroscientists and psychologists and roboticists. There's a lot of discussion going on, a lot of workshops where those, and philosophers too, come together and have these discussions.
So in 30 years, do you predict that we will have robots changing the sheets in the hospitals while the nurses take care of other and more important things?
I think that we can't quite... Go ahead, Ron.
I think 30 years from now, we're going to have many more robots in our lives. In the last 5 years, we've gone from really no robots in the military and no robots in homes to thousands of robots in the U.S. military and millions of robots in U.S. homes, floor cleaning robots. I see that change to continue and increase over time, especially as the baby boomers get older, the number of working-age people relative to elderly people goes down. I think we're going to have to find ways of increasing the productivity of those working-age people to satisfy the demands of the cranky old baby boomers like myself.
But we just have to hope that the robots don't become too human and resent having to do all of these mundane tasks.
That sounds like a Hollywood script, doesn't it?
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. It's been fascinating. I've been talking with Professor Rodney Brooks of MIT, Professor of Robotics, and Robin Moranz-Hennig, contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. You probably saw her article in yesterday's magazine called The Real Transformers. And if you haven't, or if you just would like to have a refresher course, you can also find a slideshow of some of the images of the new robots on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you both again.
Thanks, Leonard.
Thank you. We'll be right back.